Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Okay. Hi, is this thing on? Yes, there it is. You can hear me. If my earring starts clicking, I will take it off. I'm told that there's a problem with the earrings, but we're hoping to keep them on. Welcome to the Sydney Writers' Festival 2019. My name is Lisa Lucas, and I am the executive director of the National Book Foundation and one of the guest curators of the festival this year, which has been really exciting because I got to look through all of the lists of everybody who was coming months ago and figure out how to take some of the conversations that we were having back home and really have some very meaningful discussions about them here, and also to just basically go through the list and pick all of my, like, heroes and have an opportunity to have a conversation with them down here. This panel is called Outside Voices, and we've got Rebecca Traister and Meg Wolitzer. The Sydney Writers Festival thanks them for their support of the festival. And you know what? The Welcome to Country is something that we don't do in the U.S., and I think that it's really a big honor to be able to do it here. So I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this land, and pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. Couple housekeeping things happening. Please turn all of your mobile phones to silent. There's always, like, somebody who doesn't, so just, like, check it. We ask that you do not record the event. Please keep photos to a minimum and use the hashtag Sydney Writers Festival if you are tweeting. There's going to be time at the end of the session, about 10 to 15 minutes, for questions from the audience. And then a very important thing is to buy the books if you have not yet. The authors are going to be signing after the session. The venue staff will be able to let you know where the signing location is and direct you. So buy them, buy all the books. Books are good. So now I have the pleasure of introducing you both. Two brilliant women who are right smack in the middle of helping to smash down the patriarchy, which I appreciate tremendously, and have contributed to the crucial... Yeah, that's like, yes, goodbye. And have contributed to the crucial conversation the world is having about women's lives and feminism and how we move forward through their acclaimed works. We'll be talking about how you write women in full relief, how you tell women's stories across genre, and how we can change the way readers understand themselves through literature. I will also be talking about the evolving articulation of female rage on the page and why once unsung and sidelined stories of female fury, friendship, mentorship are so present in the cultural conversation today, although, of course, all of these things have always been so. And our authors themselves. So I remember when Rebecca Traister's book landed on my desk. It's just this white book, if you don't have it already, with simple red lettering, right? But what it says, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger, reminded me that I'm furious, that I'm completely pissed off all the time about the way that things are. We, women, are furious, and that we've had it. But it also reminds us that women are righteously rageful, but also wildly useful, that rage is a tool, and it's okay. She has been called the most brilliant voice on feminism in this country by Anne Lamott, and her best-selling books, insightful magazine profiles, and the popularity and heat of her ongoing commentary on the moment we're living through remind us how necessary her voice is to all of us. She's also very angry, yes, but it is also worth mentioning that she's a very, very lovely person. Meg Wolitzer is the author of one of my absolute desert island of every book I've ever read favorite books, and is one of my absolute favorite novelists. She's been at it for years and years. She finished her first published novel as an undergraduate. Novel after novel, 13 novels, right? 14? I think it might be 14, actually.
Who knows?
Meg has used her deep understanding of human nature, storytelling, and her ability to tell the real lives of women to write complex, layered, bold stories that have always recognized the depth, rage, intelligence, and force and friendship of women in the world. Her most recent the female persuasion, hits the current conversation about feminism right square on the head. But despite its timeliness, Meg has always been interested in women, fully drawn, lovingly rendered, complicated women, and is the self-proclaimed master of the warm take. And although we read the book first, we're all very excited about The Wife, which made an appearance at the Oscars this year, and very happy to see Glenn Close bring her very pissed off wife to the big screen. So welcome to our authors who are going to read briefly, and then we're going to have a conversation. Let's go.
Great. Do you want me to go first?
Yes, go first.
Okay. So I am actually going to read from the end of my book. I'm going to read the very end of my book. And my book is about the political power of women's anger. And it is... I began to write this book in the wake of the 2016 election of Donald Trump to the White House. And a lot of it is about the past couple of years, and specifically about some of the women in the United States. And I know this is not... Even the anger of the past few years is not... The women's marches were all around the world. I know and am learning more every day I'm in this country about the rising political anger of women in Australia. A lot of what I'm chronicling in this book is the history of how women's anger has shaped social and political change over centuries. I'm writing about it in an American context mostly, but a lot of it is true in the histories around the world. And this last part of the book is specifically about some of the women who weren't angry until very recently, or weren't in touch with their anger until very recently. And many of whom are newly angry, are consumed by that anger, are exhausted by it, scared of it, driven by it, and ask me very regularly, are we gonna change things? Are we gonna be able to fix things? Is all of this, is this a moment or a movement? Are we gonna be able to fix the world? And so this is my concluding message to them, and I count myself among them. No deus ex machina is going to appear to announce that those agitating for revolutionary change in the United States and around the world, that the project we have embarked upon is a movement. No one can promise that our work now will remap our landscape and remake our future. That burden is on those of us who want desperately for it to do so. We determine whether or not we change the world. The task, especially for the newly awakened, the newly angry, especially for the white women, for whom incentives to renounce their rage will be highest in coming years, is to keep going, to not turn back, to not give in to the easier path, the one where we weren't angry all the time, where we accepted the comforts of racial and economic advantage that will always be on offer to those who don't challenge power. Our job is to stay angry, perhaps for a very long time. If you happen to be reading this in the future, having stumbled across it in an attempt to find out if you're allowed to be angry about whatever you're angry about, let me say, yes. Yes, you are allowed. You are, in fact, compelled. And if you're reading this now in its moment with me, if you've gotten to this page, previewed early for those of you here, because you've been feeling rage at the unfairness and injustice and at the flaws of this country, my home country, but I think applicable elsewhere, and because your anger is making you want to change your life in order to change the world, then I have something incredibly important to say. Don't forget how this feels. Tell a friend, write it down, explain it to your children now so they will remember, and don't let anyone persuade you that it wasn't right, or that it was weird, or that it was some quirky stage in your life where you went all political. Remember that, honey, that year you went crazy? No. Don't let it ever become that, because people will try. The future will come, we hope, if we survive this, if we make it better, even just a little bit better, but I hope a lot better. The urgency will fade, perhaps the ire will subside, the relief will take you briefly, and that's good, that's okay. But then the world will come and tell you that you shouldn't get mad again, because you were kind of nuts and you never cooked dinner and you yelled at the TV and you weren't so pretty. And life will be easier when you get fun again. And it will be awfully tempting to put away the pictures of yourself in your pussy hat, to stuff your protest signs in the attic, to slink back away from the raw bite of fury, to ease back into whatever new reality is made after whatever advances we can achieve now. But I say to all the women reading this now and to my future self, what you're angry about now, injustice, will still exist, even if you yourself are not experiencing it or are tempted to stop thinking about how you experience it or how you contribute to it. Others are still experiencing it, still mad. Some of them are mad at you. Don't forget them. Don't write off their anger. Stay mad for them. Stay mad with them. Their right to be mad and your right to be mad alongside them. Being mad is correct. Being mad is patriotic. Being mad can be joyful and productive and connective. Don't ever let them talk you out of being mad again.
That was great.
Thank you.
I'm
Thanks.
Really mad.
The end of the book. You guys, you know.
I feel like, although I'm going to do something really different because I'm a novelist, so it's a whole different thing. I feel like, can we have a little sorbet now between the courses? Sort of clear the palate. So my novel, The Female Persuasion, which is very brightly colored and looks like this, is about many things. One of them is female power, and another one is mentorship, which is a subject that's very interesting to me and I think a very important subject. And the novel's about the relationship between a young woman named Greer Kadetsky and an older woman named Faith Frank, who's a famous feminist. I like the alliteration. Faith Frank, famous feminist. Faith is is a second wave feminist in the vein of someone like Gloria Steinem. She's very stylish, but I tried to invent my own character. Greer has been groped at a frat party at college, and Faith, who is now in her 60s, long past when she became really, really big in the 1970s, is still on the college lecture circuit, and she's come to Greer's school to speak in the chapel, and Greer, who doesn't really have the feeling, wait a minute, this thing that happened to me, do I have a right to be upset by it, or should I just suck it up? Is that what being a woman is like? Men sort of say things and do things. She doesn't really know. But here, Faith has come. So this is just a little bit from Faith speaking at the chapel. At the podium, Faith said, "Whenever I give a talk at colleges, I meet young women who say, 'I'm not a feminist, but,' by which they mean, 'I don't call myself a feminist, but I want equal pay, and I want to have equal relationships with men, and of course I want to have an equal right to sexual pleasure. I want to have a fair and good life. I don't want to be held back because I'm a woman.'" Later, Greer understood that what Faith had actually said in her speech was only one part of the whole effect. Really, it was about more than her words. What also mattered was that it was her speaking them, meaning them, conveying them with such feeling to everyone in the room. "And I always want to reply," said Faith, "what do you think feminism is other than that? How do you think you're going to get those things if you deny the political movement that is all about obtaining that life that you want?" She stopped for a moment, and they all thought about this, some of them surely thinking about themselves. They watched her take a slow and deliberate drink of water, which was somehow, Greer realized, highly interesting. "To me," Faith continued, "there are two aspects to feminism. The first is individualism, which is that I get to shape my own life, that I don't have to fit into a stereotype, doing what my mother tells me, conforming to someone else's idea of what a woman is. But there's a second aspect too, and here I want to use the old-fashioned word sisterhood, which may make you groan a little and head for the exits in a stampede, but I'll have to take that chance." There was laughter. They were listening. They were all with her now, and they wanted her to know it. "Sisterhood," she said, "is about being together with other women in a cause that allows all women to make the individual choices they want. Because as long as women are separate from one another, organized around competition, like in a children's game, where only one person gets to be the princess, then it will be the rare woman who is not in the end narrowed and limited by our society's idea of what a woman should be." She stopped and looked out over the whole room, sweeping her gaze across them. "So the next time you say I'm not a feminist, remember all of this and do what you can to join the fight, which is ongoing." She paused. "Oh, and here's a final thought. Along the way, as you're fighting for what matters, you will definitely come up against resistance, and that can sometimes be upsetting and even throw you off course. The truth is that not everyone is going to agree with you. Not everyone is going to like you or love you. That's right, some people will be really mad at you and maybe even hate you, and that is going to be hard to accept. But my feeling is that if you're out there doing what matters, if it's any consolation, I love you." She smiled a brief, encouraging smile at them, and that was it. Greer folded. She was taken in completely, taken up, wanting more of this forever. Faith had made her little joke about loving them. But as Greer listened to Faith, what she herself felt seemed closely related to falling in love. Greer knew all about falling in love. This was like that, but without the physical desire. The sensation wasn't sexual, but the word love still seemed relevant here. Love, which pollinated the air around Faith Frank. So I'll stop there. So, thank you.
Amazing. So why do you write about women? Why do you both write about women? You're both very different writers, right? You're doing totally different types of work. The novel is so different from all the different types of nonfiction you were writing. Mm-hmm. But why? And why is your form, you know, why did you choose, how did you choose to write the way that you write to and about women?
Well, you know, people say to writers all the time, write what you know. Have you heard that expression? I think to me, it's more write what obsesses you. There's one good way to know what obsesses you, but nobody would ever want to do it. Look at everything you've Googled for the past 24 hours. You will know yourself. For me, it would sort of be a combination of Virginia Woolf and does this mole look suspicious? But I don't really think that's good for a book. But I tried to think about what I was thinking about. I started writing this book long before the Me Too movement. These are not new ideas. The feeling, some of the ideas and themes are things I've been thinking about. I feel, and I say to students, because I teach a lot, what are you thinking about all the time? I try to work something out that I've been thinking about or stewing over. And often I've been thinking about inequality. My novel, The Wife, if some of you saw the film played here, I think. If some of you saw the film or read the book, that was about a different kind of anger. It was about marriage and about imbalance of power. So these are ideas that I've been thinking about my whole life. So rather than going and writing about a book set on a sloop when I've never been on one, I thought I would write about these women and how they're figuring out how to live. So that's how I do it. Yeah.
And I think that my answer is related, even though we're in different fields. I became a journalist by accident, and I should say I am a feminist journalist. In my day job, I write these books. I wrote my last book was about unmarried women and the history of unmarried women, often in relation to the social and political movements in which many of them were active. My first book was about women in the 2008 presidential election in the United States, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and Michelle Obama, and issues of race, gender, and class. But my day job is writing often about politics now, but in the past also about entertainment and culture from a feminist perspective. And I was born in 1975 and came of age in the 80s and early 90s, which was an absolute frozen wasteland of anti-feminist backlash. It would never have occurred to me as I was growing up and thinking about what do I want to do with my life. I mean, I didn't ever think, I thought journalism was a very glamorous profession. It is not. However, I thought, as a young person, it wasn't something that I thought, oh, I'm going to be covering politics. Nothing could have been further from my brain. But as a student of fiction, of literature, in both high school and college, I was constantly writing from a feminist perspective. Mm-hmm. Again, there's no way to sort of say, oh, right there, I knew I was a feminist. Right. I don't even know if I identified it. I wasn't an activist. Even in my college years, right. I didn't participate in any of the sort of anti-date rape, take back the night stuff. I had no hand in that regard. But in my thinking, in my reading, I was thinking about these issues about women and power. And it's women and power is really,
that's really interesting.
That's the intersection.
It's endlessly interesting.
And that brings you to all these places. It brings you to marriage. It brings you to politics. It brings you to elections. It brings you to pop culture criticism. It brings you to questions of friendship and how friendship is portrayed. And when I did become a journalist in my 20s, and I was trained again to not, my initial training as a journalist was don't write about anything you care about. It was the opposite. It was learn how to write write a lead and write what's called a nut graph that has all the salient information at the top of a story. Learn how to cultivate sources. Don't write about anything you have an opinion about. And I did that, and then as soon as I was given the freedom, sort of let off the leash and said, now you can start writing about what you want to write about, I immediately went to thinking about women.
Right.
And then I sort of created a beat for myself as a feminist journalist. Right. But it's a different, just a different path of exactly what Meg's saying. These are the stories that have obsessed me, and the lucky thing, I think, for both of us is that many of them have been undertold.
Right.
There's a lot of ground out there.
I heard this anecdote. The writer Mary Gordon was on a panel with the writer Grace Paley, And somebody asked Grace Paley from the audience, do you write like a woman? And Grace apparently said, if a horse could write a novel, or if a horse could write, it would write like a horse. I'm a woman, so I write like a woman. I'm a feminist, so I write like a feminist.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like I'm going to put on that hat. I wear it to sleep. So I write about the things that I'm sort of figuring out and thinking about. I think that's where the best writing comes from, across the festival. The things that people are thinking about anyway and would be thinking about even if you didn't pay them to write about it, that's the stuff.
And it's almost about having a lens that you can... I was thinking about this yesterday specifically with regard to the question of anger and looking at the world and looking straight at anger from women instead of trying to get around it or avoid it or cover it up or disguise it with humor or whatever, looking straight at it. But I think it applies to what we're talking about writing about women too. It's like so much around us, we're trained to sort of put the women to the side in ancillary or tertiary roles, to make caricatures out of them. And if you just slide on the glasses, which I guess I've had on both as a woman and as just somebody who's been curious about these issues from childhood, the world looks totally different if you put women at the center.
Right.
Whether you're telling fictional narratives or non-fictional narratives, if you have the women at the center, there's like pathways and connections and relationships that suddenly are visible to you, and you sort of want to describe that world.
Right.
And they're new because, as you say, people haven't really taken them on before.
Right.
The field is ours.
Right.
We're going to take over.
Right.
I mean, we got it.
Right.
I wrote a novel called The 10-Year Nap that was about... women who have children and quit their jobs and suddenly 10 years have gone by and these women have to figure out what to do. There were like very few novels about mothers and children that weren't kind of like making fun of them, sort of mummy lit in this sort of sardonic way in which the mothers at the end of the day were getting drunk because it was so horrible. But the idea for me as a novelist, all I want to do is show what is it like. That's my mantra. What is it like? What is it like? Why not write about that time of life? Why not write about it? Why is what happens in the boardroom more important than what happens in the and at home, you know, when you're raising a child? It was interesting to me to write about the family structure.
And what Meg's saying about she started the female persuasion, and I can attest to this because she and I talked about it from in its early stages, years before, long before Trump, long before the 2016 election. And even in this case, which was, this book was written after the 2016 election. I wrote this one very quickly, which is not typical for me. But I made the decision. I know there was a day that I decided to write a book about women's anger. And it was the last week of 2016, before the start of 2017. And it stemmed from a very casual conversation that I was having where I was with my husband, where I was saying, I don't know what my job is moving into a future Trump administration as a feminist, as a white woman. What is my responsibility? And I can't think clearly because I'm so angry. And I saw the anger as an obstructive force. And my husband said, why don't you write about the anger? And this suggestion that I could just look straight at the anger, not my own, this book is not about my own anger, it's about the, you know, but the to anger. Look at anger instead of something that is obstructive or clouding or makes you irrational as actually a rational and clarifying force historically and politically was so incredible. I went home that day and I wrote an outline of all, you know, how women's anger has been marginalized and written off, you know, the history of it through the social movements, through abolition, through civil rights, through suffrage, through the labor movement. I wrote all this. And it's actually that outline that I wrote that day is the shape of this book. And that was before the Women's March, before the hashtag MeToo movement, before the sort of wave of political activism, and in the United States, a historic number of women running for office. And it's not that it was so predictive any more than Meg's book was so predictive. It's that we were thinking about the world through that lens.
Yeah.
And when the world rose to meet it, we were
there.
We were writing about it.
Right. So what does that mean, right? Like, so if you had walked into a publishing house and you had said, I want to write this book about women's anger, I wrote last night this outline, and here we are, and it's 1995, what happens? If you want to publish The Female Persuasion in 1995, and you were, you know, publishing books at that moment, what does that look like? And now that you can, what does that mean for readers?
I think it's different for Rebecca than for me with nonfiction, but for me, I mean, I think they would have let me do it, but they wouldn't have thought that, you know, even when I began writing it, my editor was always very supportive of what I want to do. But at the beginning of writing this book a few years ago, it wasn't where it's at the way it is now. I mean, I went back, I finished this book before the 2016 presidential election, and then it happened, and I had sort of ended the book with this sense that Hillary would be president, and as some of you have heard, that didn't happen. And I was kind of pacing my house, and I realized that I wanted to go back in and do a kind of epilogue, because maybe it wasn't that things were sometimes a little better for women, sometimes a little worse. What if the whole thing got pulled out from under you like that magic trick with the tablecloth? So I wanted to thrust my characters into a more uncertain future. And as I did that, there was this nascent new kind of feminism emerging. So I sort of acknowledged that as well. I think that fiction, I don't like to read fiction that's disposable or feels like it's just for the moment. It needs to be about something more than that. So, you know, who knows if anything's going to last? I have no idea. But I wanted to sort of set my characters into a kind of still-moving future. And that's, I think, where we are right now, in a still-moving future. Things are still changing and moving. And that's what fiction can do. It can track the changes. But they would have let me do it, but when I started writing it, they were happy as long as the characters felt really lived in, but we didn't know that feminism would become, you know, as hot button an issue as it is now.
I suppose the question too is, yes, that, like, I agree, but your books were sold very well, right? We're here in Australia, you know, invited to an international festival to discuss books that are deeply feminist and baldly so. And they were sold well. Publicity teams, they're both bestsellers, right? This is not to my, you know, there was nothing like this when I was in, no, you know, no. 1995, when I was 15 years old. There was nothing like it. And so I'm just curious, too, about, like, what is meant to young women to see these books? I guess I started with, like, a false question, which is just, like, no, in 95 it would have looked different, I think.
I want to say that it also looks different in the process.
Yeah.
Because I have to say that I have a wonderful publisher in Simon & Schuster, and this is now the second book I've published with my same editor, and who's a wonderful editor and a woman who I took this idea to, and she was immediately enthusiastic. Yeah. I will say that when I said I wanted to write a book about women's anger, there was not universal enthusiasm at the publisher.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So my editor was extremely enthusiastic. I think I'm allowed to tell this story out of school around the planet. But I cannot say that there was an immediate embrace, and there was, I mean, and I'm talking about, I had conversations with other editors, just, you know, sort of curious conversations with other editors, conversations within my own publishing house. There was a remarkable gender breakdown in January of 2017 about whether or not it's worth it to publish a book about women's anger, and there are a lot of men involved in the publishing process who I love, who I know feel, you know, warmly about me and my work, who were like, I don't think so, angry women.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Couldn't you call it good and slightly annoyed?
I think that it is, even in this moment where there is a sort of much vaunted investment in popular feminism and a kind of pop feminism emerging, it's still, there are areas where people are still made very nervous by it. And that's in sort of one of the most broadly popular feminist moments of my lifetime, certainly.
Right. You know, Meg, your books, you've been publishing for years, and your books have always been feminist.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm the daughter of a writer, and my mother, I watched my mother's experience, which was really different from mine. She started writing late, I started writing early. I mean, she sold her first novel at 44. I was 22. The joke in our family was that my grandmother was going to be 88. It didn't happen. But when my mother's first book came out, she'd been a housewife, and her parents never thought it was important for her daughter to go to college. So she is really kind of an autodidact, but she's amazing. Her name is Hilma Walitzer. She's 89. And I remember there was a review that said, housewife turns into novelist. And she's joked that it was as if she was Clark Kent going into a phone booth and becoming Superman. Housewife turns into a novelist? How is that possible? So I saw that kind of condescension. And even though we didn't talk about it, and I don't know what she thought about it, it really stayed with me. So the things that you care about, the way you see the world, the injustices, or even just the sort of subtle things that you see, for a novelist, it's all about nuance. I mean, one of the things I like about being I admire Rebecca so much and her work and how bold it is, really, because I love sort of hiding behind, you know, Susan turned to the refrigerator. Not me turning. No, it wasn't me. But I think that really the things that you've been thinking about anyway gives you a chance to sort of saturate yourself with them over time. It's not just about writing. It's what do you think about when you're lying in bed? What do you think about when you see your friend's marriage? All of those things.
Oh, it's 100%. It's what I marinate. I mean,
it's marinating. Yeah. It's really a kind of marination.
It's your life. It's just your life.
And so I think a lot of people feel that way, that, you know, people are feminists. They believe in themselves. They believe in having rights. They believe in telling our stories. But you both read passages that were about how hard it is to do this, how hard it is to be mad, to stay mad, how hard it is, you know, through the characters, that people won't like you, that this is going to be hard. How do you both find, and why do you both find, the courage, the perseverance, the, you know, the stamina, whatever you want to call it, to keep writing these stories?
I mean, at this point, and my work has become increasingly political. Mm-hmm. So I've always had the feminist perspective, always had the interest in women in power, you know, whether that's writing a thesis on Clarissa, right, you know, as a third year undergraduate, or mm-hmm. whether it's this book. But part of it for me has been about an education, my own education, the kind of message, that the passage I read about, you know, stay right in this, even though it's hard.
Right.
When I started writing about feminism for a public audience as a journalist, it was very rudimentary. I had very little analysis of race or class, and I had not taken women's history. Again, like I'd been this, and it was hard. Part of the hardness wasn't just people saying, oh, you know, ugly young woman, you're only mad right because you can't get laid, which was most of what my hate mail was in my early years when I was in my 20s, was you're just mad because you don't have a boyfriend, and that's why you hate men so much, and that's why you're a feminist journalist. That part was like, okay, one level. The other part was from people who knew a lot more than me about the history of what I was writing about and about feminism, and there was a sort of challenge to get better and think more and learn more about what I was doing, and that created an arc for me, mm-hmm. Where I was learning. I had to sort of teach myself the history and the writers who'd been where I was before me and who I didn't know about. And what it did was create, because I had to go back and do that reading mm-hmm. and learn, was like, oh, yeah, part of this deal, part of being engaged in this conversation is the fact that it's hard. And it's hard not just from the people who sort of hate you ideologically, but from your own allies, the people you want to be working alongside. And so it was instilled in me from the start, as soon as I started to learn what I was missing, mm-hmm. that being part of a push-pull, constantly fraught conversation was the deal. That was it. There was, and so that's been my career as a feminist right. journalist from the start. It was sort of forged in challenge. Some of it challenge I'd like to discard, some of it challenge I want to take on board and right. make my work and thinking better, but that makes it more comfortable for me. I've had the skin, you know, I've developed a little bit of a thick skin and also learned that being porous in other ways is really good for the work. Mm-hmm. And so it's easier for me because I have a lot of experience. For people who are new to the fight and are right. sort of blown back by the intensity of it, because when you're talking about gender and power, which is also always inherently talking about race and about money and about class, you are disturbing the ground. Mm-hmm. There is no easy path into this conversation where everybody's going to smile at you and tell you, we just love your work, terrific, you know, you're wonderful. Because it is a fundamental challenge to how power works around the world. And when you actually mount a challenge to a power structure, that power structure, is going to bite back mm-hmm. in one way or another. And so for a lot of people who are new to that, who right. are recently enraged, right. the amount of pressure coming at them is very sudden. It's not me learning to be a journalist as a young person and learning, you know, sort of all the things I don't know. It's sudden, and that's part of, you know, but that's part of the deal. If you want to be engaged in this conversation, and again, I believe we're all compelled to be.
Right.
It's... you're constantly going to be getting it from different angles.
And the novel, I think, is like a whole other
story.
It's a different
thing.
It's a different
thing. Yeah, that's not my experience.
Kind of like, you might put something on the internet and get like 1,000 hate mail things back, and people are like, this right. terrible feminist. But Meg, your journey is really different. It's still quite challenging to tell the kind of stories you tell, I think.
It's, you know, for me, I wrote an essay for the New York Times Book Review in 2012 called The Second Shelf. And in fact, I'm doing a panel called The Second Shelf here. Mm-hmm. what a coincidence, referring to it. But one of the I talked about the different ways that men and women were treated as literary writers in our culture. And one of the things that I talked about actually was book covers, actually looking at our sort of title-heavy book, at our sort of big print book covers. I noted, looking around at books, that there were a lot of books by men that had big typeface that seemed to suggest to the reader, this book is an event. And then there were books by women that had what I jokingly called in this essay, little girl in a field of wheat covers. And the idea of imagining two men sort of standing on the train station, hey, Bill, what's that you're reading, little girl in a field of wheat? You know, you couldn't say, ah, I read the sequel, little girl in a field of rye. You know, you could not imagine that. And what was happening was that these books were being funneled to particular readers. The books for women, they were the publisher was essentially saying, men, stay away, this isn't for you.
Right.
And that would affect the book's trajectory from how it was received by a critic, how it might get prizes or not get prizes, because it might be seen as what is called women's fiction, which then is something that men don't read. And I've been really interested in looking at that, but I'm not a polemicist. I don't want to write novels that are making a point and knows, and the novelist knows the point at the beginning. I don't know what those books are, because it's all about the discovery and finding out what I want to say. And it's not only one point, it's many. I mean, because this is about female power and misogyny, but it's also about making meaning, and it's also, in a big way, about the person you might meet who sees you and sees something in you. So I don't, they're political, yes, and I don't think I can ever go back. I don't want to go back. I mean, because what I'm thinking about now, the way the world has tilted in recent years, the things that I'm thinking about, I'm already beginning writing my next book, and it's like every book, it's like a relay race, passing the baton. It's like the baton keeps getting passed, and it's that same baton, but it changes shape. I'm still interested in what it's like for women in our world. How has the world been skewed for women? What does it feel like? The novel is a great forum for class, to study class, and I think that's something that I've written about quite a bit. It's really interesting to me to look at class in the novel. I mean, reading Edith Wharton, you can see that so very clearly. It's a, for some of you who are writing fiction, it's a great sort of container for ideas around difference and class. But I don't ever go into a novel saying, this is the point I want to make, because I think then I would be a polemicist. It wouldn't work.
Yeah. You know, so to that idea of, like, what the novel can do, right, one of the great, big, giant challenges of feminism right now is intersectionalism, right? That you have an enormous swath of women, you know, who feel marginalized from the conversation. How do you use fiction to sort of draw those? Because I'll start, actually, a little earlier. I think a lot of young women are reading both of the all of the work that you're both writing. And I think it's changing what they will write and what they will believe and think through having access to more visible, better writing about women in this current moment. But how do you continue to cultivate sort of equitable, you know, inclusion in this work, given that you have all kinds of different women reading, where 30 years ago, there was no mandate to sort of speak to Black women, to speak to Latino women, to speak to global women?
To some degree, I think that goes back to what I was saying before about from the moment I set my foot into writing about issues of social and political inequality, it was immediate that I began hearing from people who were pointing out to me where my what I didn't know.
Right.
And there's a lot of it.
Sure.
And so, again, for me, the whole process of learning to be a feminist writer has been one of learning all the things that I don't know.
Right.
And, you know, like, you know, at 100th of the way there.
Right.
But there's also, what that also means is that there's no way that I can do the work that I do without it reflecting the massive amount that I have been learning, and also without citing all the people who are teaching me.
Right.
And so in my work, it's a little bit easier because I am quoting, telling the stories of the people who are
right.
informing my work. And I have the capacity to quote them, to, you know, to relay their narratives, their experiences, and it is my responsibility. Often I go toward the people, I seek out some of the voices that are bringing me things I don't think of myself, perspectives, experiences, points of view. But it's an ongoing, it's an ongoing project. I would think that it in many ways would be harder in fiction.
Well, you know, in fiction, if you please everybody, you're pleasing nobody. I mean, you know, this idea, I don't want to write a book that offends no one. I mean, I don't want to offend anyone particularly, but people have different views because they have different histories themselves. Reading a novel is, you know, in this moment in the 21st century, the novel sometimes feels like doing scrimshaw. It feels like something from the past, doesn't it? Because it's low tech and it's interior quite a bit. Those of us who love fiction understand it, but the idea of sort of getting people to understand why read about people who don't really exist, what are you getting from that? It is hard. Also, using words like intersectionality in a novel kind of falls flat on the page, you know? I mean, it's
for
like...
For what it's worth, it also falls flat for me. I mean, in journalism, I very rarely use the word intersectional.
Right.
For a similar reason, I think.
You want to keep free of certain language and jargon, and I mean, that's not jargon. I mean, it's a legitimate word, but you know what kind of lies dead on the page and what is vivid. I had to show in this book, Faith Frank is criticized as a second wave feminist. There's a hashtag white lady feminism and finger sandwich feminism, which I was very proud of that one, I have to say. I wanted to write about the differences between the generations. I'm just, again, it's about what is it like looking at people, not coming up with solutions, not also, people want, in fact, to sort of have you pick a side. Mm-hmm. Which feminism do you relate to? I was asked that so many times during interviews. Which one is yours?
Right.
You know, and I don't want to do that. I mean, the reason I write novels is because I never want to do that. I'm just showing what is it like at this moment in time. I think what novels give us is a snapshot of a moment in time, and that can be deeply personal, it can be deeply political, and it can be both.
Yeah.
I also want to say something about the question of diversity and inclusion. I think that part of something I've come to recently is there is this sense, in the same way that we take masculinity as a norm and a narrative norm and a human norm, whiteness is often taken the same way, I think.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I have been working to do is think about how it's my responsibility to examine whiteness. It's not simply about... It is in part about looking outward and expanding, but it's also about being critical and clear-eyed about my own racial position and the racial position and what whiteness means within the stories that I'm telling, so that race doesn't just mean non-whiteness.
That's right.
Whiteness is one of the crucial things that we all need to be exploring at this particular moment around the globe. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's another key component, that it's not just about race, you know, inclusion isn't just about looking outward, it's also about self-examination and examining what has been historically a norm for all kinds of bad reasons and what that norm has wrought.
Which in looking at Faith and Greer, it helps. Like, sometimes you see people do things on the internet and you're like, ugh, how could you even get there? And I think fiction, for me at least, it's like, oh, that's how this mistake got made, you know, versus sort of understanding the sort of historical relevance of why somebody did something.
Right. One of the things that I have taught myself really the hard way is that you have to allow your readers to be pissed off at you for the things that your characters do. You know, it's not about likability. We should have a panel called likability, because that's a big issue in fiction, certainly, that's often leveled at women.
Why and in politics.
And in politics, yes. Huh. Uh-huh. Why, whatever are you talking about? Uh-huh. The idea that characters are going to do things that are piggish and awful and classist and wrong and blind to the world, and but if it's right for that character, you have to let them do that.
Yeah.
So you have to let your characters make terrible choices sometimes.
In this world, though, is it scary to do that? Like, I have to say, I mean, I'm a black woman, and I feel like that gives me some coverage in some ways when I'm talking. But if I were, like, a white woman writing about feminism for the world and having to sort of, in fiction, you know, show the mistakes, you know, kind of go places that are scary to go, or have to, you know, write this whole book and sort of say, this is a place where there is a tender spot, this is a place where I need to cover, you know, or not cover, I mean, because obviously you're loving and learning, but like where there's a real issue in how it might be received by people. It seems like a very tricky balance to write even about
women
right now.
Well, you don't think about that when you're writing, though, do you? Do you think?
Sure, I do, but...
Like, as you're writing, you do?
No, well, I mean, the question of as I'm writing, like, I'm always writing. I mean, sure I do, but I also think that, I mean, and this is the way...
I also don't write, so I'm not very brave at all.
Well, no, but sure, but I also think that the... If that's the big risk I'm running as a white woman, mm-hmm. that I'm going to get yelled at, mm-hmm. probably correctly. You know, I think that there's a way for people who have historically not had those kinds of vulnerabilities and not been susceptible, where there hasn't been the amount of critical yeah. voice from the margins mm-hmm. that could penetrate, so that when you made your white lady blunder, there wasn't going to be a set of voices loud enough yeah. to actually, when suddenly right. those of us who have had that kind of privilege in the past, that privilege is compromised, it feels like we're under attack. Right. And that's like a reversal of, a perceived reversal of power. We get that a lot right now.
Right.
This is the thing, you know, where in a Me Too movement, it's like, mm-hmm. but I'm worried that my sons are going to be falsely accused, mm-hmm. right? That's the outsized fear becomes the inverted, like when the person who's used to having an amount of power that is outsized.
When it's threatened,
it becomes, that person becomes the real victim, right?
Right.
Like Brett Kavanaugh is the real victim, you know, it's a
and
witch
then you're
hunt.
In like crazy upside down land.
Right, and yeah. and I am making a comparison between me and Brett Kavanaugh here, which is saying like, if the real risk that's being run is that I'm going to get called out for being racist, then that should really be in perspective, and like the issue is...
Right.
Like, it's not my vulnerability that's right. the problem.
Right on. All right. I think that was, unfortunately, my last question for you, but very fortunately for everyone in the audience, time for you guys to ask questions. I think there's going to be folks with microphones who are running. If anybody has a comment that is not actually a question, what are we going to do? Not ask. All right, cool. Now that we got that sorted out,
there's a couple.
Who's got a question?
Oh, there's some.
Right here in the white shirt that's looking back like it's not her?
Well, I think the mic is over there, though.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Thank you. Meg, you've alluded to this a little bit, but if we've got any anger in an argument, I always see as being sort of negative. It sort of creates a wall. And, you know, I'm being taught that, you know, or I know that the world is held up by two genders, male and female, and we need to get men in on the conversation and not feel defensive. So anger can often stop the conversation, but also can mean that we're not reaching out enough to the men to listen to these stories, to the point of about the books that they can read and what they're being encouraged to read, etc. So I'm just interested to know what you think about actually reaching out to men to listen to this, you know, narrative.
Well, I think my books, or any novelist's books, really are available to all men and women. But, you know, interestingly about fiction generally, not even fiction by women, I think Ian McEwan did a kind of thought experiment, walked around a park in London, have some of you heard about this? And he gave out books, and he could not give novels to men, he said. It was hard to get men to read fiction. You know, I do think I reach out in that I write the books I want to write, and there are male characters in them and female characters, and they're there. And I feel that men who, you know, look, it's been a thing about, you know, women reading books about the female experience and the male experience, and how much harder it is generally. Again, there are a lot of exceptions to get men to read books about the female experience. There was a study done, like a small one, though. I don't even want to call it a study. It was sort of anecdotal. Somebody looked at the numbers of books that had won major prizes that were from a female perspective, and there were very, very few. Because you could have Wolf Hall, but how many books were from a female perspective? Mm-hmm. I don't know how to reach out as a novelist. I mean, I do a lot of public speaking, and I publish a lot, and the books are available, and men can come into the bookstores. I do have a lot of male readers, I will say. So I think to some degree... That is, and I hear from men, so I think that's happening, and to writers I know as well.
I also want to say that my book is expressly about anger, and I was sure that no man would read it. And I was shocked by how many, I continue to be shocked by how many men I hear from. And in fact, I think the best review it got, like the rave, you know, one of the best books in the year in the Washington Post, was by a man. The first great review it got was by Carlos Lozada.
Yeah.
And it was by a man who was sort of like, oh my God, I didn't realize
that's all of this. That's why they gave him the Pulitzer Prize.
That's right. Yeah. I essentially won the Pulitzer Prize. That is not true.
By proxy.
But, you know, I also want to very quickly say that the way you describe anger as immediately putting up a wall, that can be absolutely true. And one of the things that I talk about very often when talking about anger and the communication and expression of anger, especially from women, is that we are taught from birth that anger is a wall. When anger divides, it destroys, it explodes bonds. All of that can be true. I'm not going to pretend that that stuff isn't true. But a lot of what I'm arguing in this book, and that I really, really want to say, is that women especially are told to rear back from anger for that reason, and we're not taught about its other properties. The expression of anger can connect us to people. A lot of what I write about is the way that expressing our anger, which we're dissuaded from doing at all times, which winds up isolating us and making us feel nuts in our anger and alone, and like we can't communicate it because it makes us weird and hysterical and over-emotional. But when we actually express it, that's often when we find each other and find other people who share our anger. It's the building blocks of coalition. Now, often that might be with other women or other marginalized people, but I'll tell you something. Talking to men, it is communicative too. It can connect you and make you better understood, better known, better heard through the men in your life. That doesn't mean aggressive yelling. Anger is not always a fight that's going to shut something down. Anger can be enormously connective between people. And so remember that when we instinctively don't turn to anger because we are sure that it's going to be about wall building and division, that's not always the case. It can also be about human beings seeing and knowing each other better and more fully.
Yeah. I just want to add really quickly, my novel, The Wife, that was turned into the film, I think the strength of Glenn Close's performance was about this anger building, and it was mesmerizing to people, and I think it was mesmerizing in the context of this moment, and people could not look away from her face.
And the wall that is often constructed is when it's not expressed.
That's right.
Nobody tells us that, but like when we keep it all inside, we are becoming unknown. Like there's something, we have a whole universe in our heads.
Don't you want to be known? We want to be known by the
people in our lives. And when some of us, especially those of us who are marginalized, I'm writing about women, but this happens, you know, all other ways that it's cut. The suppression of our rage keeps us alone. And talking about it and being with each other and letting each other know about what we're angry about.
And keeps us as a kind of cliche of a bitter, bitter person who is just like the person in your office who's
right.
And
that is
doesn't
when
say
it poisons us. When it poisons us and when it's bad for us is when it's stuffed down deep. You know? And all the stuff we have about anger is bad for us often is when it's like this anger. Yeah. Right? Rather than like, no, let me tell you how pissed off I am, which is also anger. But it's communion.
Because it's a way of being articulate.
Yes?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. We're getting off on that.
We're getting to that, yeah.
More questions. Yes. We've got a hand here.
Yeah.
Cool. Hi. Hello. Hi, my name's Gareth Ernst. I'm an artist. I've been drawing you. I hope that's been okay. This has been talking. I'm a man, okay? My father was military. My grandfather was military. I've grown up with brutality, violence, and rage, that male rage. You know, they were trained to kill. I've grown up we've all grown up with boxing, where we see on television men punching each other in the face as a sport. You know, that terrible, terrible, constant, acceptable anger. I've grown up with this testosterone-driven rage. It's the definition of my gender. The question, I guess there's two kind of questions. What is it? Is there a difference between male anger and female anger? And I guess the last one, how can feminism help men?
Mm. All right.
So what you describe is incredibly evocative of precise, I mean, you're answering your own question. In that, yes, men's anger, again, we go back to the idea that men, often white men, have been assumed to be the full imaginative human being. That's and as such, their anger has been something that has been so normalized and in various ways appreciated, applauded in a sporting or military context. You know, anger gets sort of fused with and connected with physical brutality, with power, and that brutality often gets read as strength, leadership, physical, athletic talent, sport, right? Entertainment. Again, all of these versions of what we can understand in some way derive from rage or aggression. There are all these other channels of it in politics. It's, you know, a passionate leader, a driven man, right? And so as much correction as we need to do about unteaching women to suppress their anger, there's also a huge amount of correction that has to happen where we have to address some of the ways in which men's anger has been over-encouraged. And in fact has been fused with all kinds of physical violence and the protection of the boundaries of gender and race, domestic violence, police violence, military violence, right? So we have to, the project is not simply, a lot of what I'm doing here is addressing women, but there is this massive other project. And as I was saying, that a lot of what my work is about addressing whiteness and acknowledging whiteness. There's this whole other project, which is acknowledging masculinity, right? That gender is not just, you know, femininity or feminism. That gender studies are also about masculinity and how it has been formed and celebrated and understood. And so, and I think, I hope, in answer to your second, so your first question is, yes, I don't know that there's differences in their anger. There's difference in how the world has apportioned power to men and women, and thus how anger has found its has been manifested by men versus by women. In terms of how feminism can help you, it can help challenge exactly the kinds of brutality and narrow assumptions that you were raised and clearly are suspect of and to some degree correctly fearful of and worried about. Yes, feminism is to help men. Feminism is to help us all get something closer to a full human experience of sharing a world, sharing our lives, our families, our relationships, our planet on more equal and generous footing with each other. Yes, feminism can help you.
Yeah.
And reading Meg's novels. Seriously, the novel. Yeah. I mean, it's like makes you more empathetic. It makes you bigger.
Yeah.
It helps you to connect to the ideas, right? Like, I think this is such a one. I'm sorry to talk. We have one more time for one more question. But the 1-2 punch of these two on one stage, right, is that I can learn so much from Rebecca. I can learn so much about the history of feminism. I can learn so much about my own rage. And then I can connect to it, to like the actuality of what that looks like through reading Meg's work, like what that looks like as a person living in the world. And I think for men who are not always paying attention to what women are doing, who are not always looking at the detail, at the like texture of it, the novel is really important. So when Meg was saying that like men aren't reading novels in the same way that women are, I think that that's a huge part of it. That's a huge part of it. So that's another, you're not here to listen to me, but one more over here. Yeah.
I just finished Female Persuasion. It was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm here today with my beautiful female friends. And I get so excited. I get so emotional. I want to go out and do something. And then I go home, and I've got my child, and I've got my husband, I've got work, and everything kind of gets in the way. So I guess the question that I want to ask both of you is, what kind of three practical things can I do right now going home in this world that we live in to make a big difference, or to make a small difference, really?
Oh. Well, I think you can convey your passion about equality to your children and if you have a partner. I think that's really, really important to convey it by not only by what you say, but by how you live. I think does that count as one thing?
Mm-hmm.
Here, why don't you take the second one?
I insist. I'm very empathetic. I have two small children at home. I have a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old, and it's the sort of thick of it. I don't know how old your children are, but there's this sort of like, oh my God. And you know, I'm lucky in that my job permits me to be engaged in this because of my work itself. But I would say that one of the key thing is engagement. And that can take any number of forms. So it might be political involvement. It might be, and I don't know if you're, I couldn't tell from your accent if you're Australian, if you're engaged in the upcoming election, or if you're American, you're engaged in the elections there, which roll out on a humane two-year basis, 2 years worth of campaigning. It can be something like that, but it can also be educating yourself. It can be doing the reading on things that you didn't know, whether that's reading the newspapers every morning, which is something a lot of us have grown out of the habit of doing because of the availability of quick headlines. It can be simply immersing yourself in really understanding some part of the world or some part of the politics that you don't understand. That's been a huge part of the activation in the United States, where, and I gather that in Australia, from everything I've heard, there's also a challenge with political apathy in this country. And a big thing that's happened in the United States in the past 2 years is that people, many of them middle-class women or working-class women who have kids and full-time jobs and sometimes multiple full-time jobs and haven't had time to be engaged in their state and local politics have suddenly, under the like sort of horrifying cartoon threat of Donald Trump, not that he's a cartoon, but it's like so caricatured, you can't believe it, have gone out and learned the stuff about their local school boards, their local community elections. Then in the United States, it's state, it's local, and then the federal congressional elections, all not just the presidency, which historically is what all anybody cares about in the United States. And that's something that can happen here too. That's something that happens around the world. We get in our phones and our kids and our job, but if we start reading the papers, it can be reading the history, it can be reading the other feminist voices, other feminist novelists, it can be going back, reading the 10-year nap, which gets to a lot of this exactly the situation that you're in right now, yeah, to some extent. And so a lot of it doesn't have to be out on the streets, but it can also be joining a community group that gets you out of the house maybe once a month with, if you find other women or other people who are engaged in some of the same political interests, or even through reading books, a book club that's, yeah, sort of progressively minded that draws you to other people. And then with those other people, you might find yourselves doing things like whether it's going to protests or sharing your stories with each other. That is all part of being engaged. The biggest thing is whatever form your engagement takes, whether it's like leading a parade down a street, or whether it's giving money to a candidate who you just learned something about and think would make a really good leader, whether it's running for office yourself, whether it's writing yourself, writing your own story, telling a story you've never told it. That's what Me Too is about. It's the simple act of telling a story that we've held in. Mm-hmm. It can take so many different forms. What it is being connected, is opening your mouth or opening your brain and your curiosity to, and being engaged in these issues and not being silent.
I would say related to that, and this is a little more abstract, and this is something that I wish I had done when I was young, is not caring so much about what people think of,
right,
you. I think that's really, really paramount. If you can actually, I would even say this, put it on a sticky on your computer screen. Seriously, don't care about what people think. You know, you can be truer to who you are and who you believe. I once did a panel with two writers, and one was very famous and one was had her first book out. And after the panel, the young new writer said, how do you two write about the things you write about? I'm afraid of what the people, of the other parents at my kid's school will think. You know, it was something about like sex or sexuality. And I thought, wow, you're going to hold yourself back for people you may not even like that much. I mean, I don't know, you know. But the idea of really not caring so much, I think that you can live a truer life if, yeah, you care less about that.
Wow. Unfortunately, they weren't able to get to three full ideas for what to do. That was a joke. That was like 300 was like different ways. Well, thank you so much to these two brilliant women for being here. I feel really lucky to.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
As mentioned earlier, there are books for sale. The books are wonderful. They are signing them. I cannot encourage you enough to buy them and to have them signed. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you to you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.